Why are girls in India more likely to become scientists?
There was never a sense that these were subjects that would be difficult for girls or even something girls wouldn't be interested in.
Why American girls are still less likely to study science and math, and how education and business help discourage the women who buck the trend. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. What is keeping American girls out of laboratories? A study by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in 2011 found that women are vastly underrepresented in science, technology, engineering, and math, the fields known collectively as STEM. Women make up half the workforce, yet they hold less than a quarter of STEM jobs. And women with a STEM degree are more likely to work in education and healthcare, not research. Yet, women in STEM earned 33% more than comparable women in jobs outside the science and math fields. Sarah McConnell has a report that looks at the issue from a number of angles.
The first real surge of women engineers came with World War II. Laura Puaka, an historian at Christopher Newport University, studies that moment in history.
Oftentimes, when we think of women in World War II, we think of Rosie the Riveter. This is sort of like her cousin, Edna the Engineer.
Today, women in overalls, women in war jobs, are to be found throughout the length and breadth of America.
Puaka says that during World War II, more than 250,000 women trained for jobs as engineer's aides.
So essentially, these were sub-professional positions where women assisted with things such as drafting, and in reality, they were serving primarily as assistants to higher-ranking men.
After the war, as things heated up with Russia, there were suddenly more and more science jobs to fill. But this time, the jobs weren't for women. In fact, Laura says women engineers and scientists faced a hostile environment in the post-war period. But they fought back.
These women's engineering societies spring up in the immediate post-World War II period.
In 1950, several of these small women's organizations pooled their resources and formed the Society of Women Engineers.
They held meetings where they would counsel each other, they would give each other career advice. They would also try to recruit and encourage young women, so high school students. They would participate in career days, try to provide young women with female role models in the field. They wrote guidance literature targeted toward young women.
But in the era of McCarthyism, all this talk about women in the workplace could be seen as subversive. So the society argued that women engineers were necessary if the U.S. wanted to beat Russia.
They did take such care in crafting this public image as not a feminist organization, even though the kinds of activities that they were promoting and endorsing, I think many folks would consider feminist initiatives, but rather they tried to frame them as service to the nation, service to the state.
And they made a good case, pointing out that Russia had more women engineers than the U.S.
They estimated that in the United States, women engineers hovered around 2% of the engineering population. But they pointed out that women engineers in the Soviet Union represented nearly 30% of the profession.
Today, there are women scientists and engineers who are still making these same arguments, that women don't just need science and engineering for their own sake, but for the sake of the nation.
But things haven't changed much since then. Only 91 women earned PhDs in engineering in 2008. That means women made up less than 3% of the engineering PhDs. Reporter Kavitha Cardoza was born and raised in India, and her experiences there offer special insight into the problem of women and the STEM fields. Kavitha is here with me now. Hi, Kavitha.
Hi, Sarah.
Kavitha, you moved to the United States from India more than a decade ago. And when we were talking earlier about your experiences there, you said something that really surprised me. You said that women in India don't really have doubts about their abilities in math and science.
That's right, Sarah. In my high school, the STEM subjects were seen as cool, and almost all my friends went into STEM careers. There was never a sense that these were subjects that would be difficult for girls or even something girls wouldn't be interested in. I went to a very regular school with all kinds of students from all kinds of backgrounds. I think just culturally, science and engineering or the STEM subjects are just really elevated and given kind of a place of pride.
You weren't interested in particular in math and science yourself, were you?
Not really, but I have four sisters and four of the five of us have gone into STEM careers.
In what way? What did they do?
So my elder sister has a PhD in clinical psychology. I've got a sister who does stem cell research. I've got another sister who's a radiologist, so she went into medicine, a range of science-type careers. It was just not seen as unusual at all.
What did you think when you came to America and heard people debating whether women were as adept as men in the sciences?
I think it really, really surprised me. What also surprised me are kind of the cultural aspects, really. For example, when I arrived, there was the Barbie doll controversy. You know, they had the Barbie doll saying, "I hate math." And I remember thinking, oh my God, they wouldn't even sell one of these in India because girls are so encouraged. You know, the STEM subjects, it was so wonderful if you went into them.
So do you think in India, especially, push was made to bring girls up to a par with men in terms of the expectations of them in school?
I do. So it's kind of interesting because you have huge parts of India where girls don't even get basic education. So that is kind of a separate story. But if you're talking about the middle class in India, I don't think it was a special push. I think it was just an expectation. Why should the STEM subjects be different for girls than they are for boys? I mean, we don't say, oh my gosh, history is easier for boys or for girls, you know? I mean, they're just subjects to learn. And I think when you take away the value judgment, you find lots of girls and boys love all kinds of subjects.
You have looked into what is happening in America regarding this cultural bias or stereotype. Have you found indications that the American stereotype against girls in STEM continues into college and university level?
Yes. Actually, in 2012, there was this really fascinating study, Sarah, that showed a bias in favor of men in science. So there were two sets of science professors at universities, and they were asked to judge graduate student applications. Each set was given identical applications, except one set were given the name John and the other the name Jennifer. Judging competency on a scale of 1 to 7, John was given an average score of 4. But Jennifer, remember, this is an identical application, except for the name. She was given an average score of 3.3. Professors also said they were more likely to hire John. And the average starting salary offered to John was $4,000 more than the average salary offered to Jennifer.
That story comes to us courtesy of With Good Reason. If you missed it, WAMC did a series on women in STEM that is archived on our website. Search for Access to Advancement or Women in Science on the Air at WAMC.org. Coming up, more on science, women, and breaking down artificial career barriers. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1241. In her role with the Chemical Security Engagement Program of the U.S. Department of State, Nancy Jackson travels throughout Asia and the Middle East, and she is seeing a big change happening. Women chemists are thriving there. In most parts of the Middle East, she says there are more women studying chemistry than men. She talks about this increasing role women are playing in science internationally.
Well, I'm Nancy Jackson. I'm the immediate past president of the American Chemical Society, and my day job is at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I help to support the U.S. Department of State in a program called the Chemical Security Engagement Program, and that allows me to work with chemists in Southeast Asia, South Asia, and the Middle East, and sometimes even North Africa. And that has been one of the highlights, has been the highlight of my career, has been to meet chemists, and I've most enjoyed meeting women chemists from developing parts of the world. They face different situations than I do, but they are some of the most dedicated, caring individuals I've ever met in my life. And I'm very impressed by them and very lucky to have gotten to meet many of them. Some places that I go, for example, in Malaysia, the chemists there have better situations, fairly good equipment, and are doing some very interesting sort of research. But some of the places I go do not have really very safe labs at all. In Egypt, there's a lot of challenges. For example, in both the National Research Center, their big government laboratory facilities, as well as some of the universities I've been to, there are difficulties in getting rid of old chemicals and this sort of thing, and yet they still sort of march on, and they are training the future and helping to develop their country. They're all very concerned about the environment, making things happen, being involved in sustainable growth in some way or another, and it's very impressive. I've been doing this job for about 5 years, and even in that short a time period, I have seen a few things change, particularly in Gulf countries. So this past year, I went to the Kuwait Chemical Society meeting, and I had been to it a number of years ago. And this year, I saw women chemists wearing Western clothes and not even covering their hair, which I had never seen in Kuwait before. So there's things are changing. Women are becoming more involved. In most parts of the Middle East, there are more women studying chemistry than men. They are becoming more and more involved after they graduate, not just teaching, but doing other things, becoming professors at universities, leading centers at universities. There's a very talented woman who's leading a center at Jordan University that has to do with materials and nanotechnology. So I'm seeing women gain power in the scientific community all over, and it's really exciting.
Nancy Jackson works for the Chemical Security Engagement Program of the U.S. Department of State. That interview comes to us courtesy of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and producer Mia Lobel. Sharon Haney, principal investigator at DuPont, received a B.S. in biochemistry from the University of Pennsylvania and a Ph.D. in chemistry at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She shares the advice that helped her make the most of her experiences.
My name is Sharon Haney. I'm a research scientist at DuPont Central Research, located in Wilmington, Delaware, the Experimental Station Laboratory. The notion of having a shell or some protective skin, I think, is very critical, particularly at the time I emerged as a young woman in science. And there was one particular individual, a professor, Dr. Phoebe LeBoy, who just recently died, who was a phenomenal mentor, activist, advocate for women in the sciences. And what Phoebe did for me in particular was she was one of just two women in science whom I met when I was in chemistry at the University of Pennsylvania in the 70s, early 70s. And I had her as my thesis advisor. And what she left me in terms of, it was a lifelong legacy, but it was simply words. I mean, some challenging questions which have served to be sort of like neon signs that come up and emerge, you know, flash every now and then. I remember what Phoebe said. And it served to, I think, enable me to rapidly develop that thickened skin or shell that would sustain and protect me from the forces that I think often knock women off of the pipeline in their science. So this was the last semester. I graduated early from Penn, so this was in sort of November-December timeframe of 1976. And we were just having our final discussion, so to speak, in terms of, this is my send-off interview with Phoebe, and she says, Sharon, you are, you know, extremely bright, very highly motivated, but I'm concerned that that's not going to be enough for a woman of color going to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Department of Chemistry. Said, you know, I'm worried that you're not going to last, because that's not all that counts. You're going to have a lot more understanding of the way things work, in the sense of being, I think, a political sensitization. And I had no clue what she was talking about. I mean, in terms of the reality of, you know, it really was an old boys network. I mean, I saw the reality in my classes. I mean, I was always the only person of color and predominantly all white and largely all male. Women were still a fairly small number. And so, you know, so I recognized the reality of what my community of cohorts and peers was, that I was, you know, a rare species, but I was still undaunted by the odds and just assumed that by virtue of my academic success that it would be a clear road ahead. And so her words to me, which were lasting, was that for a woman and for someone of color, just being smart is absolutely not going to be sufficient for your success going beyond. You're going to have some, I guess to use more current vernacular, sort of street savvy, if you will, political savvy in terms of how the world works. And so going to MIT, I was open to the experience of engaging in a more sort of open and genuine way with other people on that journey of color and women. And I found those alliances to be absolutely essential. And understanding the value of community and creating networks of support, sharing stories of how to navigate different survival skills and how to thrive. And so it was tremendously important what she said. I don't think I would have done that had she not hit me on top of my head, so to speak, with the words that she spoke to me that morning.
To hear our growing archive of stories from the field and to comment on the story you just heard, visit chemheritage.org/storiesfromthefield.
We go district by district to other schools, teaching children things which affect their lives.
Let's hear from a younger but equally determined role model. Hakima is a 13-year-old Ugandan girl and a volunteer of the child rights organization Plan International. She's leading child rights initiatives in her school and her community. Hakima attended this year's session of the UN Commission on the Status of Women, where she was interviewed by UN Radio.
Most girls, we have so many things which affect our lives.
Give me an example of two.
Girls are forced to get married when they are still young.
Who forces girls to get married when they are still young?
Their family members. Even cultural beliefs. They believe that girls must get married and so that they become strong and well.
What about school?
They don't want girls to go to school, that boys, they will help them if they grow up. They talk so many things that boys will do. But us also, girls, we believe that we can.
Now, what do the fathers say? The fathers don't want their girls to go to school?
Yeah, there are some fathers who don't want, and also there are mothers who don't want. If a mother says that my girl is going to school, and a father says that this girl is not going to school, do you think that who will win strongest?
Who will win?
Sometimes the father. If it could be me, the mother, I will win.
How would you make sure that you win?
For me, do you know what I do? If he goes to work, I go and I register the girl. If the girls go to school and he asks me, I just say, I'm the one who paid school fees. Now you go and remove her from school, we see. If you will, you will find that everybody knows your name, that you don't want your girl child to go to school, and you'll get real ashamed.
Now tell me about your visit here in New York at the United Nations.
My visit here is to learn more about Commission on Status of Women, things which affect women and girls.
And you know, the theme of this session of the Commission on the Status of Women is violence against women and girls.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Is that a serious problem in Uganda?
Yeah, it is very serious where girls are circumcised.
Let's talk about your schooling. You seem to be enjoying going to school.
Yeah, I enjoy.
What are you aspiring to be when you grow up?
I'm aspiring to be a doctor.
Why would you like to be a doctor?
For me, I would like to be a doctor so that in case of a woman giving birth to a baby, I help.
Hakima, a 13-year-old child's rights advocate, was interviewed by UN Radio. Finally, as many stereotypes as there are for scientists, there are an equal number for mathematicians, math geeks, human calculators, nerds. But commentator Tracy Wu has an essay on why it's important to embrace your inner nerd and follow your interests.
Go ahead. Ask anyone. I'm a huge nerd. I've learned to accept this, but I will admit I did not start out one of those proud to be me, so screw you types. Actually, I desperately wanted to be cool, but it just was not in the cards. First, I will lay some of the blame at the feet of my parents. They were strict with me. And by strict, I mean they never allowed me to do or have cool things, which in retrospect was really brilliant. I was allotted 30 minutes of television a day until junior high, and I wasn't allowed to listen to secular music. I consider this the catalyst of my nerdish ways. If you can't watch TV or play with the newest, most popular toy, what do? You read, you write, or pursue some other nerdish hobby. My lack of 80s pop culture knowledge still shocks and horrifies my friends. I mean, I didn't watch The Goonies until I was 25. Part of this is my ethnicity, as politically incorrect as it may be to say. Asians are supposed to be smart, and while it's a stereotype, at least it's a positive one. Being one of only a handful of Asian kids in my town, I think teachers and classmates just assumed that I was smart, whether or not they were right. So I was treated as a nerd practically on first sight. And while my parents were by no means the strictest of parents in our Chinese circle, my father certainly made it clear that academics were a top priority. However, I can't blame my parents or educators for all my nerdishness. Throughout high school and college, I began to embrace it and would happily admit to myself that I enjoyed tearing apart Shakespeare's plays and eschewing the mainstream. Of course, this was after trying to be cool and pretending I liked the clothes, magazines, music, and whatnot that my peers were into. But I found I never really truly enjoyed any of it. And I'm pretty sure everyone saw right through me, which probably made me even nerdier in their eyes. Now that I am an adult, I am proud to announce, via public radio, that yes, I am a nerd, and I am proud of it. I don't want to listen to pop music in my car. I'd rather listen to NPR and learn something of the world around me. I don't subscribe to tabloid or women's interests magazines, mainly because, as a nerd, I believe that it's a waste of paper and harms the environment. That, and they don't teach us much more than who is sleeping with whom and how to wear lipstick well. I will choose styles of clothing that I am comfortable in, not because they're hip or in fashion. I prefer thoughtful news and documentaries to trashy reality shows. I will constantly be in the middle of two or three books and stay up half the night reading them. I am never going to have a clue who the newest IT actress is until she's no longer IT. None of this is going to change, and I accept my permanent nerd card with pride. In saying this, I don't think that being a nerd is a bad thing. Some of my best friends are nerds. Actually, all of them are. They are intelligent, well-read, thoughtful, insightful people who know what's up in the world. They have ideas, they create things, and they're more wrapped up in improving things than they are in themselves. And I consider all of these traits good things. So go ahead. Embrace your inner nerd. It's the new cool.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.